Hello, and welcome to Talking Global Infrastructure. I'm Matt Dickinson, Head of Communications and Marketing at the Global Infrastructure Investor Association, and I'm delighted to be joined for this episode by Ben McAdams. Ben has worked on infrastructure policy at all levels of US government, having served as a Utah State Senator, Salt Lake County Mayor, and US Congressman during the height of the COVID pandemic. He is now working with the Government Finance Officers Association on the Putting Assets to Work Incubator, which is aimed at helping local authorities to better manage their balance sheets. He's also a senior fellow at the Sorensen Impact Center. This is an exciting time for infrastructure investment in the US, with this month marking 1 year since sign-off of close to $370 billion worth of green incentives and tax breaks contained within the Inflation Reduction Act. Ben, thanks so much for joining us. I wonder if you can kick us off by taking us through the work you're currently doing with the Government Finance Officers Association and what led you to spearheading that project.
Yeah, well, let me start talking about the time when I was mayor. I was mayor of Salt Lake County. This is a population of about 1 million people. We had a budget, annual budget about 1.3 billion US. And I just found it frustrating when I was mayor to, you know, we know that it's so much less expensive to maintain our infrastructure than it is to rebuild our infrastructure. And yet we didn't have the resources to do basic things, to fill potholes and to maintain our roads. And we just waited for our infrastructure to fail until we would have to rebuild it. And as I was looking through our government and a new mayor starting to understand our government budget and how our resources flowed, U.S. governments really do a poor job of looking at the balance sheet. We have a pretty good job of forecasting our revenues that are coming through taxes and forecasting our expenditures. But when it comes to the balance sheet, it really is only in recent years that U.S. governments are even expected to have a balance sheet. And so now that we do have a balance sheet, that balance sheet is really based at like acquisition value. So we don't have a good sense of what we own. Hence, I think part of the reason why we don't maintain what we own, we don't invest in our infrastructure, but we also don't know what assets we have that could generate potential value. So realizing, I think that some of the easiest assets to look at were our real estate. I commissioned an exercise where we inventoried all government-owned real estate that had commercial viability, that was commercially viable within our jurisdiction. And it's not impossible to have this. We have it in our computer systems. They have tags to, you know, the government properties, so it's all knowable. But not really something that we focus on. So we pulled it out, created an inventory of all government-owned real estate, and then we don't really have a value for this real estate because we don't estimate the market value of this real estate because it's non-taxable, and the only reason to estimate the market value is to know how much taxes we would charge to a property owner. And since government properties are not taxed, we don't know the value. But we were able to make some assumptions and back into the value of our real estate portfolio. And what we found was shocking to me. We estimated that Salt Lake County had commercially viable real estate assets, underutilized or unused real estate that we had acquired over the course of decades or even 100 years. And our real estate portfolio in its current state was valued at about $12 billion. Then we looked at what real estate, how the private sector was using real estate in the neighborhood of our government parcels. We looked at parcels within 500 feet of a government parcel. And we estimated that our real estate portfolio, if managed properly, should be worth about $45 billion. So incredible incremental value that was just lying around waiting to be put to work. At the same time, you know, my frustration was that we have $45 billion really under the mattress waiting to be activated, and we can't afford to maintain our infrastructure. We're letting our infrastructure fail while there's resources available to make that happen. So that was the genesis for me of putting assets to work, identifying our assets, understanding what they're worth, understanding the opportunity cost of just leaving them latent, and then figuring out how to activate them. I joke that it was shortly after we started this process that I ran for and was elected to the United States Congress. So my joke is that I spent 6 years as mayor, learning to work across the aisle, to build relationships between Republicans and Democrats, to balance a budget, to act in a fiscally responsible manner. And I gained all these skills and took them to the United States Congress, where those skills are useless. They don't do those things in Washington. I spent 2 years in the United States Congress, as you mentioned, during the height of the COVID pandemic. I was actually one of the first members of Congress to come down with COVID and saw firsthand how the United States was dealing with that, those challenges. All the while, again, our infrastructure continues to fail. So now that we're in a new paradigm right now with the infrastructure Inflation Reduction Act and investments coming forward in infrastructure and climate infrastructure, but it's still, I would say, not enough. And at the same time, governments have these resources of assets on the balance sheet that aren't recognized, that aren't valued, and aren't used. In 2020, I actually lost my reelection to Congress and found myself back in the private sector, but still committed to values of public service and wanting to find ways to benefit our communities. And so this concept of putting assets to work and the latent value that is existing in commercially viable real estate is something that I think has transformational value for cities across the U.S. So in 2021, I partnered with the Government Finance Officers Association to create the Putting Assets to Work Incubator. In this process, we selected six U.S. government jurisdictions that we would work with to help them to identify the real estate, the commercially viable real estate that they own, and the potential for public-private partnership and private investment in that real estate. So we worked with the cities of Atlanta, Cleveland, Annapolis, Maryland, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Lancaster, California, and Harris County, Texas, which is the Houston area of Texas. All of them, through this process, we identified have billions of U.S. dollars of investable real estate that could receive private investment to create opportunities to invest in some of their greatest challenges. And so this putting assets to work process with those six jurisdictions was incredibly successful. We are looking to do to launch another cohort of putting assets to work, and we'll be announcing in the next few weeks new jurisdictions that are joining this effort that we will do the same thing. We'll go in and help them to inventory their assets and identify opportunities for private investment that can unlock capital for public good. The other challenge that we're looking to do is really to take these opportunities we've identified and position them in a way that they are primed for private investment. These are going to be opportunities from small housing developments and housing projects on small parcels to very large parcels that can be sources of major infrastructure investment. We think there are opportunities across the board for these jurisdictions to create value through public-private partnership and private investment.
That's fascinating, Ben, and really interesting to know that many authorities, I'm sure, are sitting on that kind of really substantial untapped potential that you talk about. It'd be interesting to know, perhaps drawing on your experience at all levels of government, what you see as the primary barriers to more effective public-private collaboration.
Well, as Gia knows, this concept of using public assets and professional management of public assets to generate return is not new. It's you know, asset recycling or concepts that are very common in the UK, in Australia, in Scandinavia, in Europe, where governments will take their publicly owned assets and professionally manage them to create opportunities and revenue back to the public sector. This concept, unfortunately, is not very common in the U.S. And some of that we think is, you know, having worked at all levels of government, from the state level to local government and federal government, I think that's part of the problem in the U.S. is our government is so fractured by design that you have cities and counties and states and federal government. But even within that, you have housing authorities and transit authorities and school districts that where the government power and the decision-making power over these real estate assets is divided and very fractured. So I think that makes it hard for us to take action, to have a central authority that is acting and managing
professionally managing our real estate assets. It makes it frustrating for private capital that may want to come in and invest in U.S. real estate that they just don't know who they have to talk to. I think one of the other challenges for the U.S. to take this sovereign wealth fund approach to managing our assets is the fact that we just don't have visibility and transparency about our assets. So I described that process that we had to go through, even though those assets are all in a computer system somewhere, they aren't really accessible and visible to mayors, to governors, to elected officials to really see what those assets are. And when we do have visibility on those assets, we don't know what they're worth. So to the extent that we have a balance sheet, it is acquisition value. I'll tell the story of a one jurisdiction we're working with. They had the mayor looks out at a parcel that's across from City Hall in downtown, and it's a vacant significant parcel that's vacant in an area that has high values and high need for land for housing development. And the mayor asks, who owns this parcel and why is it sitting vacant in our downtown? And the response is, after they look into it, that it's actually the city that owns that parcel. And they ask, why is it vacant? And they say, well, it's not vacant. We actually use it for a very important purpose. Our Department of Corrections is using that parcel. 3 times a week, they use that parcel to stage buses for prisoner transport to and from the jail. And so it's a critical use. We have to use it for this purpose. There's nothing else we can do. And the mayor asks, well, what is this piece of land worth? And they look in their system and they say it's worth $20 because 60 years ago, the city purchased this parcel from the transit authority for $20 in what was clearly not an arm's length transaction, not a market rate transaction, but they logged it in their system now as the value of that parcel is $20. So if you're an elected official and you think you've got an asset that's valued at $20, you're getting great use out of it to use it 3 days a week. That's costing $7 a time every time you park there. Incredibly inexpensive parking. But when you had the transparency and visibility to know what that asset's really worth, they looked at comparable parcels in the vicinity of that parcel, and they estimate that parcel is actually worth about $5 million. That's a different calculation. If you've got a $5 million asset that you're only using 3 days a week, you can find a higher and better use for that. And so what we found is once jurisdictions have visibility and understanding and transparency about their assets and the value of those assets, they're willing to make different decisions. And as I said, this counts for small parcels like this $5 million parcel, but also 80-acre parcels or waterfronts or some of the cities we're talking to have port areas that are in the Rust Belt. So these are jurisdictions that are no longer highly industrialized. So they have this waterfront areas that used to be shipping ports that are now abandoned and they're government owned and they have incredible value for reinvestment. And so that's what we're seeing, I think, in this process is bringing visibility and transparency to assets that will force people to make smarter decisions about the use of their assets.
It sounds as though the incubator is largely focused on real estate as it stands. Is there potential to roll out the model you're developing to infrastructure more widely? And it would also be great to get a sense of where you see the best examples of public and private working together to deliver in this area.
Well, we've certainly started with real estate because that is maybe the easiest for a mayor and a city council to understand and to see the value proposition of that. Certainly, as these jurisdictions start to get into it and look at it, then it leads to questions about airports or ports or other highway infrastructure or transit infrastructure. These big projects that also. It just instills, I think, in government leaders the mentality that we should not be ignoring our assets and that they are just out of sight, out of mind, and forgotten. But we should be thinking about these assets. What investment do they need to maintain them at an operating standard that is satisfactory to the public? But also, what value can we derive from these assets? And can we put money back into the coffers of government, back to the taxpayer who's supporting this? And so certainly what we're seeing is starting with smaller real estate opportunities that are visible and easily understandable, and then moving that to some of the more complex type of assets that aren't just fallow vacant land, but operating assets that have even higher multiple of opportunity.
And I mean, more broadly speaking, during your time as a congressman, you stressed the need for responsible management of public finances. Clearly, that's a pressing challenge at the moment, given borrowing costs are so high for governments. What role do you see private investors playing in helping governments to deliver generally for constituents day to day?
You know, as someone who spent 15 years of my career in government, I think there's value for government, but government fulfills a critical function in society that nobody else can do. We are stewards of the public trust. We are conveners of public needs and public opportunities, and we can focus that needs. But I think we also have to recognize that government has its weaknesses, and there are things that government does not do well. And that's where I'm such a strong believer in the value of public-private partnerships, that government can bring to the table the operating assets, the governing assets and abilities that is unique and valuable of government, and contribute that alongside private investors and the private sector that also brings the ability to make by the minute decisions and improvements, ongoing improvements. Government is not good at continuous improvement and monitoring of our successes and monitoring of our failures and quick correction of some of those aspects. So bringing maybe some of the government perspective and government values and government representation of the public good, and partnering with private sector investors who are good at managing for the greatest opportunity and maximizing the benefit and minimizing the cost. I'm a strong believer, always have been a strong believer, in the value of harnessing both the strengths of the private sector and the strengths of the public sector as partners that can also minimize the weaknesses of each sector to come together to maximize the benefit for the people that live in our cities. Because people ultimately don't see themselves as a constituent of the government transportation department or the housing authority. They see themselves as residents of a community that want to have quality of life, and they don't really care where that quality of life comes from. They want it as inexpensive as possible and as high quality as possible. And so bringing together public and private to do that is, I think, the secret to achieving maximum success. And private sector is going to bring opportunities and access to capital that the public sector just doesn't have, and then has the ability to manage some of these assets in a way as long as government sets the right guardrails and the right measures of accountability, that private sector actors can come in and maximize the value and the quality of assets to return value back to the public who sustains them.
Applying that philosophy to a specific challenge then, in your time in office, you called on the creativity and entrepreneurship of the private sector to help address the issue of climate change. We're speaking during a summer where extreme weather events are on the rise, and we alluded at the outset to some of the Inflation Reduction Act measures which are designed to address that. How hopeful are you about the capacity of public and private sectors to collaborate in order to get us to net zero emissions and genuinely sustainable economies?
Well, I think we are not going to rise to the challenges that are presented from climate change unless we have a strong public and private collaboration. I'm appreciative of the Inflation Reduction Act and what the resources it's brought to American cities and to the American private sector to invest in infrastructure and climate infrastructure, and also, but climate resilient infrastructure is a big need that we've only started to scratch the surface and to look at. So, you know, I'll give an example. I talked about how people who live in communities, they don't see themselves as residents of the transportation department or residents of the port authority or residents of the housing authority. They see themselves as residents of the community. And what they want is highest quality of life at lowest possible cost. We've seen insurance companies in the U.S. who are raising insurance rates and sometimes refusing to insure communities and neighborhoods because of the climate risk that they see on the horizon. Our residents just know that their quality of life is affected, their cost of living is affected if their insurance rates are going up. And government, I think, should be in the role of looking at those investments where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So investing in climate resilient infrastructure may mean lower insurance costs on the back end for communities. It may mean lower incidents of disaster. And so rather than simply reacting to climate disaster as it comes to us, getting out in front of it and looking to how to mitigate risks and mitigate the potential of disaster is a role that I think government should share alongside the private sector, that sometimes will be required to step up and pay in the case of insurance or other disasters to mitigate those risks. So working on the front end to mitigate risks instead of waiting for risk to materialize and then paying to cover the cost of those, is the person who loses in that is the individual. And so what I'd like to see is the resources that have been made available through the Inflation Reduction Act to be brought to bear in a way that, first of all, reduces our greenhouse gas emissions and helps to slow and prevent the impacts of climate change, but also investing in climate resilient infrastructure that can help our communities be more resilient and thrive in the face of the changes that we know are coming. And to do that is going to require a robust public and private partnership.
Absolutely. And to your point about prevention being better than cure, here in the UK, we struggle with a regulatory approach which tends towards keeping customer utility bills low at the expense of the long-term investment we need to secure that kind of resilience you've just spoken about there. Moving on, you alluded to it earlier, but another feature of your time in office was a focus on bringing the major parties together to work collectively on big challenges. Is it fair to say that it's a difficult climate in which to make bipartisan action happen in the US at the moment? Certainly, there's been a lot of coverage this side of the pond of certain takes at the local government level on investing according to environmental, social, and governance ESG considerations. I mean, certainly in that area, it looks as though the divide is growing rather than narrowing.
Well, I've been happy that in spite of all of the headlines nationally about and there's certainly dysfunction in U.S. federal government and U.S. politics generally, but in spite of all of the dysfunction and the disagreement and contention, we've actually had a productive couple of years under the Biden administration, the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, and other measures that have actually passed both with a Republican Senate, or I'm sorry, a Republican House and a Democratic Senate right now. We've seen progress happening in the U.S. and investments being made in key elements of our outstanding needs. So I think it's been a very productive several years of the Biden administration. We're entering into now the presidential election is starting to heat up. And as the world is watching, it is still looking like it's likely to be a rematch of President Biden and Donald Trump. And that election will certainly bring up a lot of issues. And we're seeing a lot right now. But I think the candidate who's going to prevail, the American people, really, in spite of all of the headline-driving cable news issues, American people really want to know that their government's going to be responsive to them and responsive to the needs and challenges that they face. So I think the winning candidate is going to be the one who's talking about investing in infrastructure, investing in healthcare, investing in climate. It's undeniable that climate change is happening and it's impacting people from across the U.S. and across the globe. And we are getting right now, we're in record heat waves across the U.S. People are seeing the impacts of climate and how it's affecting them directly financially, their personal finances and their quality of life. And so I think the winning candidate in the presidential election is going to be the one who talks about the election and makes the election about the American people and what's good for the American people, not about what happened in 2020 or making it about any individual candidate themselves, but really about somebody who's going to fight for the American people. That seems to be, in spite of all of the headlines and controversy, that seems to be the issue that's prevailing. We saw that happen in the 2022 midterm elections when a lot of extreme candidates, really some extreme candidates from both sides, but you saw a lot of the extreme election denying candidates lost and weren't elected. So I would just caution people what maybe generates the most headlines is probably not what people are going to be thinking about when they get into the voting booth. They're going to be thinking about who is going to provide the most stable and secure future for them and the voter and their families.
Well, you've slightly preempted my final question there, which was going to be, what would you like the presidential hopefuls to be saying about infrastructure in the run-up to polling day? I mean, are there any specific policy measures you'd like to see them discussing, perhaps taking forward lessons learned from the incubator?
Well, I do think, while I'm happy with the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law that took historic steps in the U.S. to address climate change and to help to impact, to address the causes of climate change, I think one issue that is still lagging is climate is changing. And hopefully we take actions to mitigate those changes. But in some ways, it's already too late. And so I think there's a conversation that needs to start about investing in climate resilient infrastructure. We see communities, whether it's sea level rise along the eastern seaboard, places all the way from Florida to New York that are seeing impacts of sea level rise to extreme weather events. So Texas that's seeing flooding from increased hurricane potency that is having an impact on U.S. cities. That conversation, I think, is just starting. And that is going to need to be a significant investment from the U.S. and from the private sector to invest in infrastructure that mitigates the disastrous impacts of extreme weather events on U.S. cities. And it's not going to be cheap, but it's going to be important that we get out ahead of that, because I do believe this is a situation where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I think we need to start that conversation about stepping up our investments in climate resilient infrastructure, not just preventing climate change.
For sure. Well, thank you so much for your time, Ben. And thank you all for listening to this episode of Talking Global Infrastructure. Full details about the Putting Assets to Work initiative can be found in the show notes. Please do subscribe to Talking Global Infrastructure on iTunes and Spotify for future episodes. And be sure to follow the Global Infrastructure Investor Association on Twitter and LinkedIn as well. See you next time.